You're listening to Ruining It for Everyone with your hosts Maggie McPhee and Christopher Harrington, with guest Mark Christensen. Tonight's episode, The Kurosawa Suite. This episode is sponsored by FX Factory by Noise Industries. FX Factory is like having an app store inside your NLE. Hundreds of effects are available ready to be previewed on your own clips inside your timeline for free. When you find the effect you want, click buy and in seconds you're good to go without interrupting your workflow. FX Factory is available for Final Cut Pro 7, Final Cut Pro 10, Motion 5, and After Effects. New plugins are added to FX Factory all the time. Download FX Factory for free today at noiseindustries.com/FX Factory. So, great. Well, thank you for stopping by. Thank you for taking the time. It's been... I've actually been a kind of a big fan of some of the stuff you've done, so it's been kind of crazy.
Yeah, I like your cartoons and your work at Disney.
Yeah, right. So, I did actually go on IMDb today to sort out the bifurcated, because I am a split personality right now on IMDb, so I am taking care of one of them. But that guy is not one of my faces.
It seems like that every other guest we have on, there's someone else out there with the same name who has some thing that comes up in Google.
Oh, yeah. I'm waiting for the next Highlander series where, you know, everyone with the same name kind of just goes together and just starts slaughtering each other until there's only one.
Well, it's just a test to you guys what great data miners you are.
There we are.
Yeah, that other Mark Christensen, he's an animator. He's got a blog where he draws little cartoons and stuff, right?
Yeah. Right. And the style is pretty cool as well. I mean, it's good mm-hmm. stuff. It's not run-of-the-mill, random stuff on...
No, he's like an actual, you know, working animator.
Yeah.
Yeah, I haven't looked at what he's been up to lately, but I know he started out on Animaniacs.
Wow. Oh, wow. That's a blast from the past. And one of my favorite shows of all time. Right. Although, I think we're getting a lot of background noise on your end. Do you still have that window open or...?
No. I think that's actually the fan on my beloved MacBook Pro, which is just sitting on an ottoman. Let me see if I can stick it on a book. Maybe something, maybe Flash is running or something. Let me see if I can kill a browser. Okay. Yeah.
I could recommend a book for you to set it on. It's kind of thick, but... Hey, I'm sitting here beside a copy of After Effects CS4 Visual Effects and Compositing Studio Techniques by Mark Christensen right here in my hand. So I wouldn't have bought the new one if I didn't like the old one.
Yeah, well, the skeleton of the book hasn't changed. Like the bones, the structure, the publisher actually, I think, would like me to change it just for the sake of changing it. But in fact... You know, what I've done in each edition is freshen it up within the framework of that same basic setup because it's funny. When I got the first contract to do that book, it became an excuse to go to Indonesia for the summer and write the book there, which you can imagine how well it went maxing out a 60-day visa in Bali on my book contract to get the book done. But by the end of that trip, I did have the outline really well done, and I had the book really well researched. So, and that part actually was worth putting that kind of trouble in. The problem I had was that I hadn't written a book at that point.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, the trouble of being in Bali for 2 months, that's very difficult.
Well, and it got kind of ridiculous. You know, I was trying to tell myself I was there to work, but... I would usually work pretty well during the AM hours, but it would get closer to noon and I'd be like, come on. I mean, I'm in Bali. What the hell?
I'm in Bali. Yeah.
There's a beach for that.
Yeah.
Oh, my.
Yeah. But yeah, that outline actually has served it well. And I always meant it to be a little more advanced than some of the other books out there. So kind of the first section just brings everybody up to speed with kind of good habits with After Effects itself. The second section's all the fundamentals of compositing in large, like roto, tracking, keying, color matching, camera. And then the third section is more recipes for specific types of shots, if you will. And none of it is step by step. I mean, you guys all know this, but I'm just running over it because there's bound to be somebody listening who's not intimately familiar. And so it was all aimed at somebody who's a bit familiar either with video or with After Effects, but kind of wanted to raise the game in terms of VFX compositing. So it has kind of remained the book for that. Most of the other After Effects books give it its due as a motion graphics or hybrid application. And when I wrote it, you know, when I did the first one, I had been working at the orphanage where we actually used After Effects on feature films, which is something that just doesn't happen anymore other than for title sequences predominantly, but maybe a little shot here and there. After Effects is very dominant in television, but feature films, of course, no.
Right.
But at the time, it was really up for grabs. And even so, on Day After Tomorrow, when the studio kind of got the report that we were using After Effects to comp their shots, we might as well have said iPhoto, you know?
Word.
Yeah, but I had to, on that show, teach a bunch of Shake compositors how to find their way around the app. And that was really the experience that informed writing that book for the high-end people. And I also taught a class at the Academy of Art, and that gave me that sense of what people who are just coming to this kind of cold would want to know. So that was what spawned the book. It was really, I mean, the orphanage and Stu Mashewitz in particular, who I counted the number of emails we exchanged before that first book at one point, and it was something like 500.
Wow.
Yeah. he's a busy guy, but when he wants to throw down for something or, you know, he just has his interest, he'll dedicate time and energy.
That's really
Well, one
cool.
of those interests definitely is After Effects. I guess between the two of you, I'm not surprised how much work the orphanage put into After Effects.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, at the time, Stu was really holding the line for After Effects. Other people were rumbling and grumbling, but really there was no great alternative. Nuke was kind of just barely a product, and it looked like they hadn't even finished the UI at that point. And Shake nominally was the app of choice, but what it had over After Effects was that it was more straightforward for comping work. It wasn't particularly more powerful.
Right.
There would sometimes be fewer steps, and so the Shake artist would be maddened by kind of how much extra trouble they had to go to, you know, something they would want to do with a node tree and, you know, doing it with layers and how lost you can get in pre-comps and so on. And that's the familiar refrain about After Effects. But the truth was, once you know the app against something like that, it, you know, it wasn't underperforming. Lately, you know, Nuke has got kind of run circles around it in terms of 3D and has taken the place of Shake as the app that is much more specialized toward feature film effects compositing. So it totally makes sense, you know, the way things have shaken out. But After Effects remains the most ubiquitous compositing application out there, partly because of the sheer number of seats, and it actually is a really good problem-solving tool. I mean, I find, and it's true of Nuke as well, it's true of Smoke, I'm sure, I haven't done it, but any well-designed app, you can think your way through a shot in it, and that's the point you want to get to if you're going to start doing really good VFX work, is to actually be able to think through a problem kind of in the language of that app, if you will.
Well, the nice thing about it is it's both cheap, relatively speaking, right? So
yeah,
it's part of, you know, the Creative Cloud at the moment, and you can get that for $30 a month, whereas Nuke is tens of thousands of dollars, not including contracts and all that other stuff. And it's a fairly, even though it's limited, it's still fairly flexible. So even if you're not going to do the final compositing, the final VFX stuff in it, you can pretty much wireframe it out, for lack of a better term, sketch it out in After Effects, just so you can get the ideas down much faster And so that's, I mean, it's a very flexible tool that way. It's really nice.
Yeah, people have a lot of the same things to say about Smoke as well. Smoke is, you know, the hybrid that throws editing in the mix so that if you want to throw together a rough of an edited piece that involves compositing, that's a big advantage there. And, you know, After Effects is kind of joined at the hip to Premiere, but they could certainly be better integrated.
Right. But they're getting there. The whole dynamic link thing is certainly a step in the right direction. I still not quite sure it's there yet, but it's certainly a hell of a lot better than it was, you know, a version ago or two versions ago.
Yeah. And that's actually something that I didn't even fully realize until I dug back into it, because I was trotting out some of the same complaints. I was actually walking around NAB with Dave Simons, who's one of the original After Effects developers, like from the beginning. And
COSA days, yeah.
Yeah. And he and I just happened to both wander over to the Foundry booth together. And I was, on the way back, I was talking about dynamic link and what I saw its flaws to be. And he actually pointed out to me a couple of things that had changed since CS5.5 that I didn't even know about. So one of the complaints used to be that you couldn't version up and, you know, it would lose your versioning if you didn't, like, if you version up, it would still stick with your old one, which is just like the kiss of death because you're versioning up constantly in After Effects. And the whole idea is not to just sit there and painstakingly track all that in another app. So I haven't banged on it hard, but that's been addressed. And, you know, that's not something that I've ever heard anybody really promote. So I'm not sure to what extent those of us who gripe about dynamic link have really put it to the test lately.
Right. There's a new pool of users who are going into the whole Premiere Pro, Adobe Creative Suite bandwagon. Yeah, they're migrating off of Final Cut Pro 7, and they're not entirely certain where to go. Premiere Pro versus Avid. Premiere Pro looks to be more approachable simply because it feels a little bit more like Final Cut Pro. And also, chances are fairly good they have some experience with the Adobe Suite, whether it's After Effects, whether it's Photoshop or Illustrator or what have you.
Yeah.
And of course, it's cheap. Avid did a nice little cross-grade promotion thing, so it's significantly less expensive than it was, but it was still out of reach of a lot of people who just wanted to try it out for a while to see if it worked for them. But I think in the Final Cut Pro era, we had that really easy round-tripping between Soundtrack Pro and Motion and all that. So if you wanted to do some lower thirds, if you wanted to do some titling, you know, you could easily go in and out of all these different apps. And it was a very, very clean, very solid workflow. And now with the CS6, we're starting to see that again. So it's kind of, it wasn't quite baked before, and now it's really starting to get there. I think they did a pretty good job with it.
Yeah, I agree. And it is easy to overlook how much more accessible these apps are. This $29.95 a month price, I mean, I know that people are still chafing at the idea of taking on a monthly, but good God, when you look at what you're getting for, I mean, even if you aggregate it across several years, and I mean, you could even say, oh, well, what if Adobe stops putting out new software, which of course they...
Yeah, that's not going to happen.
Well, if, you know, Google acquires them.
Yeah.
Or if Facebook acquires them, then that's another thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Photoshop for Facebook.
Yes, there we are.
Well, we've brought it up a couple of times that After Effects, in specifically, is it's the desert island app. If you had to have one application to take to the desert island to do all the VFX and editing work that exists on desert islands, you know, After Effects would be the thing to kind of, you know, to take, because it's not built to do everything. And I think, you know, Stu had this thing about, hey, don't grade your film in After Effects, but here, I'll show you how you could if you wanted to.
Totally. That sounds like Stu.
Pop a few plugins, you know, Red Giant plugins or what have you. You've got a good, fast grade in After Effects. Bam, there you go. The only thing I would really like, though, is a faster, real-time workflow in After Effects. If Premiere Pro with the Mercury Playback Engine can give me 8 jillion high-definition streams at once, I would really like to see more layers in real-time in After Effects.
The reason I was laughing at your metaphor Maggie, was because if you were that person on a desert island with the subscription and it tried to phone home.
Well, you'd have, what is it, 30 days before it gives up?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I'm doing the subscription and it's awesome. Because I look at it this way, I'm going to buy, you know, each suite as they come out, and it's expensive.
Right. Well, and it's funny that that's actually the first doomsday scenario I've heard that is even remotely plausible. Like, I actually would be really upset to be on a desert island with electricity, but no internet that could ping my license. But the kind of scenarios that were coming up were like, well, if Skynet becomes self-aware and the bots declare war on my machine, how am I going to composite?
Yeah, you're going to have bigger problems to solve. We're actually all going to converge at Maggie's place because she's got crazy sci-fi guns and we will be able to defend ourselves.
Yeah.
So we'll all be sitting around going, all right, you're in charge of the ammo, you're in charge of the big guns, you're in charge of this, and Mark, get to compositing that shot.
That'll fool them. That's how we win the war.
We're going to need some layers of dust, and we're going to need a good solid grade across these five shots.
Yeah, we need a logo for our rebellion.
Yes, we need a lower third for our rebellion.
Oh, sorry.
It's kind of a Rosie the Riveter thing, but she's more of a cyborg.
It could happen. Oh, my.
I had the same first reaction. I want to own the software. I don't want yet another monthly fee on my credit card. However, having said that, I actually use this all the time. It is cheaper, therefore, and honestly, when you buy software, you're licensing it. You're not the notion of ownership is a little bit illusory. Anyway, I fall into danger of sounding like I'm really like trying to promote Adobe overly, or like I would benefit from making that argument. When really, I just think, God, $30 a month to get the Master Collection is just like crazy good deal.
Don't worry, we'll do that for you. Because we've been giving the Adobe love here for a little while.
Oh, yeah. This is not faking it by any stretch of the imagination. But that's the big thing. That's the selling point with the Creative Cloud, though, right? I mean, we've kind of talked about this before, but the idea that when you pay the upgrade price, you may be paying the $400 or whatever, $400 or $500, but you're usually only getting the mini suite that you bought. You don't have access to the entire, you know, collection that Adobe has. And with the cloud, $30 a month, every app that Adobe has, why wouldn't you do that?
On any machine that you're using.
Yeah,
I mean, I have more than one machine. I have more than two machines and I can run it on all of them.
Right. I mean, it's nice to have the shiny disk, certainly, because that's mm-hmm. your fallback. Right. If you decide. Right.
But a year later, I've paid all that money for that disc. And now there's a new disc.
Anyway. You know? Right.
Right. And those have been phoning home for a couple of versions now, too. So you don't get all the advantages that you used to get. I mean, it used to be you got the disc. You could just do whatever you want. You could install it wherever you want. You know, and then gradually, okay, if they're on the same network, now you're kind of limited to two. And then it started checking for the license when you try to, you know, and so gradually it's been going this direction.
Yeah. Well, I think after the Macromedia acquisition, they got really kind of draconian with their DRM stuff, which is a little disappointing.
That's what a lot of people noticed.
Oh, they got a lot of pushback too afterwards. So.
Right.
Yeah.
I think this is another really great solution, which is instead of trying to have crazy draconian DRM, say, screw it. $30 a month, it's digital download, have at it. It just is what it is.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see over the long term what happens. It's going to just add to the number of people who inadvertently end up working in After Effects.
Right.
Because it's as many people as do it, it's a pretty small number. You know, when you compare it to even the number of people editing in Premiere, or certainly the number of Photoshop users who are going to go for that same
right.
deal.
And look at how many people are doing video on DSLRs, you know, on 5Ds, on 7Ds, on T3 and T4Is. Mm-hmm. You know, they've all got this footage now and they want something that's a little bit better than just iMovie, you know, and they're trying to produce something that looks good. So they've got the Creative Cloud. Oh, you know, I have access to After Effects. Why don't I download that? And a couple of hours later, you're installed, you're rolling. Yeah, that's perfect.
Yeah, the big hurdle is, well, it's more than this, but the technical hurdle of getting into the app seems to stymie whole groups of people. And I've actually just been working on an article geared toward editors. I decided to write a medium-length article on how an editor might find the low-hanging fruit, kind of in my book, but also just in the regular editing workflow. And it's out there. The thing is that the first thing most editors think of when they think of After Effects is actually some motion graphics piece, like maybe a whole commercial done in motion graphics, or maybe just a title or whatever. And that is some of the most complicated work you can do in the app. And it also, if you're working solo, which is the kind of scenario I'm talking about, you know, you've got an editor who now is increasingly being asked to also do a little bit of compositing, a little bit of VFX on top, because they don't have somebody just sitting at the ready to fix a shot, but it needs some love. Most guys who are thinking, well, you know, motion graphics, that means you have to be a designer, animator, and highly technical to pull that off, right? To be a really good motion, or even to be a halfway decent motion graphics person, you've got to be good in all three of those areas. And if any one of them is deficient, the work is much less. If you can animate like crazy, but you have no design sensibility per se, and you're really technical, then you could work with a designer. But, you know, it's only really if you have all three that you can kind of really produce some of the stuff that you see on Motionographer, and increasingly that's even going beyond After Effects, and you see a lot more 3D work.
And there's so much more they can do as well. I mean, I came at After Effects as, you know, an editor. I'm not a visual effects person, but I mean, there's so much stuff that you can get from it, whether it's like a quick tracking shot or something you need to do, or you need to just pull out shake or something out of a shot. You can just jump in there and do that stuff really well, really quickly, versus having to call up somebody, here, I need to send you this footage. Can you fix this for me? You know?
Well, it's no longer abnormal to assume there's going to be a little bit of comping or a little bit of cleanup. Right. Those are both kind of givens now. Fix it in post. But there's also one of the angles I'm chasing in the article is kind of the David Fincher approach, you know, The Social Network. And it's the tightening a film, if you want a His Girl Friday kind of pace to the dialogue, but you don't want to be super cutty to get it. You stay on your master shot, but you slice the shot into its participants and you speed them up individually by cutting out frames in between them and cleaning up the joins in between them. And you get much crisper timing of your dialogue than you had on set. I would say that's completely in the realm of an editor to do that. Yeah, you need to probably do a bit of tracking or stabilization on many of the shots to get them to really match. And there's going to be other stuff that is going to need a little cleanup to really make it work. But on the other hand, you know, editors are about timing, aesthetics, and storytelling. And so it really speaks to what an editor's job is all about. So even if getting up to speed with a couple of those techniques feels a little challenging, it doesn't feel so irrelevant to the job, right? It feels like something like, oh, I'm an editor. I don't feel like now I've been stuck on green screen duty, or I've been asked to design a title when I don't feel like I'm even a designer.
Well, that's just it as well, because we've got, you know, these shortened deadlines and these shortened budgets, and now editors are being asked to do the rudimentary stuff and actually sometimes some more advanced stuff as well. But it's no longer a taboo to even ask the editor to do that, because it's just, oh, yeah, sure, they have it in front of them. They can do that. And if they can't do that, then chances are fairly good on the next gig, they're going to hire someone else who does have that capability.
Yeah, that and the color correction work as well, which, again, you just can't get away without having some color skills. It's really hard to deliver a job as is anymore. You really, you're well served if you are comfortable.
Sure. I mean, every Kickstarter video I've ever seen has this amazing, you know, graded shallow depth of field, yada yada. It's like, you know, this did not happen 5 years ago.
Right.
And now all these bits are accessible.
Yeah.
You know, to people who would never necessarily pick up, you know, a camera to shoot and produce and do all the VFX work and deliver a video of that high quality. I mean, that just wasn't in anyone's hands 5 years ago.
It's really interesting. Lighting and sound used to be the total downfall, right? It was the classic sign of a low budget. And sound still causes people some problems, but they've figured out, they've got tools at their disposal to at least dub it in if things totally went off the rails. And people are a little more savvy about getting a mic out there and not using the on-camera mic. But the lighting, in some ways, is taking care of itself, because if you're using good enough glass with the light-gathering capabilities of some of these cameras and you're not just blowing it, you know... it's no longer so incumbent upon you to light the scene correctly.
You're good to go. Yeah. Yeah. If you've got 5D with a 35mm, you know, full frame sensor and really good low light capability and good glass, you know, you're 90% there.
It's a stylistic choice. There's still a major case to be made for properly lighting a scene. I mean, it's really going to look better if it's a dramatic piece, but for the kind of thing you're talking about, which might be much more naturalistic, documentary style, et cetera.
Or even just TV.
Yeah.
We'll say TV quality, for lack of a better word. That shooting for that TV look, you know, you're not having to light quite the same in general because people are used to a certain look. You can totally get that with off-the-shelf kit.
Well, that used to be, you know, 5,000 watts of light. And now you can do it with ambient. You can do it with whatever you've got around, you know, your area, or buy an LED panel or two, and for a very, very small investment, you've got good three-point lighting.
Well, and that's the other thing. Those lights are so much less invasive. They don't overheat the talent.
Yeah, it doesn't require someone to come in and hook up a service. You know, well, we're going to need X number of watts just to turn these on.
I had some Airy lights in here last week, and man, it just gives you a little bit of a headache to be around them for too long. Like if you look at them too closely, they're just, like, just a little too much.
Yeah, don't stare directly into the light.
Well, you know, when you work with them, it's hard not to get on axis for a moment while you're adjusting it. This masterpiece will be completed tomorrow, where I try to throw it down. But it's something I've been interested in for a while. And actually, I don't know if you get respondents to your podcast, but I'm just really interested to hear generally from editors who, by and large, don't make a foray into After Effects or any of the other options. They're not migrating to Nuke. They're not migrating to Smoke, which would actually theoretically be the one-stop shop. So I'm always really curious, like, what problems are coming up that editors are being asked to do. I have a decent sense of it, but it just seems like a solvable problem to me to help that set of people do a bit better. And it really is, it's a lot of job security if you can pull some of that off these days.
Well, we've got, you know, that's a fair chunk of our audience. So I'm sure someone will get back to me or Maggie or what have you, and we'll definitely forward that stuff on.
Cool.
And I think a lot of them are these kind of Swiss Army knife editors. You know, Mel, I mean, he does a little bit of everything. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of the people in our little circle, they're either utility editors or they're utility visual effects people, you know, and they know how to cut and they know a little bit about grading and whatnot. So.
Yeah.
Which is great.
And that's going to drop where, PVC?
That actually I'm writing for my publisher. It's going, I guess, on... That's a really good question. I don't know how widely they're going to distribute it. They do a whole series of promotions when a book comes out, and they just asked me to write a piece along the lines of the book, but kind of gave me free rein.
Cool.
So, but it is something that could also become a running topic on a place like PVC.
Cool.
If I were to lose my my tongue tiedness on that site.
By the way, we should probably mention for people who are wondering what book we're talking about. If you don't know what we're talking about, it's the Adobe After Effects, now CS6 Visual Effects and Compositing Studio Techniques. And it's out now in real book, and it's also in the Kindle store, which is where I got it from.
On the Kindle as well. And if you get the Kindle, you can go to the back page. I think it's still on the back page. And that's where you download all the example files. People often have that question. I just thought I'd throw that in there. The title got so long because on the CS4 edition, which you have sitting next to you, Maggie, the theory that I brought in was that the brand wasn't quite clearly identifying that this was a compositing book. And we bandied it around for a while, and everything was awkward because if you said visual effects with the title being After Effects, it was kind of, it got all lumpy. And then there was the question of like, well, I don't know. I remember having long conversations about it. We finally settled on what it is, and I thought it would be a one edition thing. I was really intending that it would be almost like a little subtitle that we just threw into that one edition to just clarify this brand is about visual effects compositing. Turned out the brand recognition probably was pretty good anyway. Like, I think people were starting to catch on that that's the type of book it was, but that was just the third one. And at that point, I still thought that was a worry. Now I just don't even ever call it by its full name because it's just too goddamn long.
Well, even the frontispiece on the CS4 edition just says After Effects CS4 Studio Techniques. But like on the front, it has the visual effects and compositing thing. So, I think, like you said, I think people kind of get a sense of what it is.
But that was the thing that actually sort of misled me a little bit initially when I first picked it up, because I thought it was going to wind up being very much a recipe book of push this button, move this slider, you know, do this, do that. And I didn't want that. I wanted to know the why behind it. And that's precisely what the book provides.
Yeah, I think initially I remember hearing that because it was an Adobe Press book. And that somehow led people to think that it was going to be more like a classroom in the book, which classically does that. That Studio Techniques series was kind of new. I think there was only a Photoshop, and I guess Jacob Rosenberg had done his Premiere book simultaneous to my first one. So we were kind of just establishing the series, but the Photoshop book was really good. And it did exactly the same thing of not spoon feeding you the basics, but going, okay, we're all professionals here. Now let's kind of get down to work and make sure the playing field's level before we power ahead with some really cool stuff. So a few other things I borrowed from that one was all the quotes at the beginning of the chapter were in that one. So there were some stylistic things that were unique to this book, but I remember hearing that. I haven't heard it much lately. I do still get people confused. They think that Adobe is somehow, I don't know, intricately involved with the production of the book. And there are occasionally people who see the logo on the cover and think it's going to be a manual. But,
right,
you know,
right.
It's likely not.
Certainly not. I mean, and that's a good thing.
Yeah, I don't think I could write one of those.
But it definitely gives you a better understanding of how the application works and how to think about your problem better and solve it through After Effects.
Right, that's exactly the idea. When we first did it, the only compositing books out there were very high level. There was Steve Wright's book, there was Ron Brinkman's book, and they were a lot of arbitrary maps and graphs and descriptions of blending modes and mathematical color diagrams of shots and adjustments. And that's fine if you want to do a book about kind of the art and science and stay above the fray in terms of software. Nobody had really done a software-tied book. Ron Brinkman's was close because he was a Shake engineer, and Shake had a lot of the same controls that were in the book. But the book never really got around to saying, hey, here's this type of shot. Let's comp some fire and let's talk about how to actually do that. So the theory when I did my book was, you know what? This is no longer somebody's private property. There's all kinds of techniques that we have to do again and again. And granted, each shot is unique. And that's the reason not to do a recipe, a step-by-step through one shot, because each one is unique. So it's useless to just memorize the steps on a given shot. You really need to be able to think your way through all of them and get the principles. And that was absolutely the kind of book that I always was committed to doing. But the theory, which I think has turned out to be pretty valid, and interestingly, although it's shifted over time, it hasn't dramatically upended, that it's really a lot of the same, like even the most complex VFX shot, and they're getting pretty complex these days, is still made up of comprehensible pieces that can also be found in simpler shots. So a green screen key is one type of A over B shot, which naturally leads you to a sky replacement. Something like a sky replacement shot is nobody's private property. It's not IP as such that belongs to anyone. It's just a need that comes up rather constantly. And the more people who know it, the less people will waste time and money trying to get the perfect conditions on the day or trying to get to the perfect location where they have just the skyline that they wanted. And, you know, the more people are able to be clever and build upon each other's tried and true techniques, then the better it is for everybody. It's to no one's advantage to keep that stuff secret. So that was the theory, and it turned out to be true. And actually, what I'm really proud of is it's in the spirit also of the old Cinefex issues that we're now reviving in this app that we put together. It was the same spirit, particularly in the early days of visual effects, where great secrets were kind of freely shared in those pages. And, you know, to where you could really go, oh, okay, wow, that's how you do the Predator effect. You just kind of, wow.
And I wanted to talk about the Cinefex new iPad app, which you happen to have authored. One of the things I really like about it is, you know, I mean, I've been a huge fan of Cinefex for forever. And I used to find it on the magazine shelves at the bookstore and pour through all the pages, read every word. And the iPad app version is actually really quite cool because the modern versions have built-in video that show precisely what we just talked about, which was all the different effect shots, breaking them all down and then playing them and then building them all back up again. And you're like, wow, that much went into it. And here are all the different replacements. Here's the different geometry that was involved. Here's the lights that were involved. It's really, really quite amazing.
Right, seeing those ABs, that's just so helpful.
Yeah, and not that long ago, I remember reading new issues in the magazine, and it might even be a film that I'd know really well, but there'd be a long passage describing the action of the scene that they're talking about. And that's always got that dissonance where if you know the film really well, you might be like, oh, okay, I know the sequence they're talking about. If you don't, or if it's a repeated sequence and they're talking about a particular thing that you didn't quite catch, you start to get a little more lost. And if you get a DVD, you get DVD extras, and you get them in the context of the film you just watched, and they're often really well done, and they'll get commentary and so on. In the case of Cinefex, it's probably the most thoughtful, kind of deep New Yorker-ish treatment you'll get of the subject matter. And sort of to inform them with the source material like that. And I have to say, it's really a testament to Cinefex standing that they've managed to get as much of that material as they have. I think they were even surprised by the extent to which studios were forthcoming.
I was totally surprised. I don't remember which issue I was looking at, but I kept expecting, okay, I saw this and there was a bunch of stuff in that, but there won't be in the next thing. And there really was. And I don't remember the thing I saw, but it was great. It showed a shot from start to finish. And like you said, it had like a sky replacement. It had effects in the foreground and all this stuff. And then you got to see each part come in. And like you say, it's a movie you've seen, but it's been a while. And when they're talking about a shot and you just see the final product, it's not the same. Or you may not even see the final product in the book. They might show you, you know. So it was really great. It's really great.
Well, and the real point is you're still going to pick up on more after you've read all about it.
Right, exactly.
So instead of straining your mind to think, oh, I see, they kind of, it just really drives it home a lot more. It is a neat confluence that it happens to have come at a time when the effects studios themselves are a lot quicker about putting together these reels. You know, it used to be much further down the road that the studio would ever get around to doing their AVs. Now they're part of promoting the studio and the film, and they're good to go with them, and they're really eager to have them out there being seen, because I don't think there's even any guarantee that they'll make it onto the disc. Not only that, but more and more people aren't buying discs. They're watching these movies in a forum where they might never see the extras. So it's a good one. Yeah, it's a really great addition, and it's not something we necessarily planned on to that extent going into it.
So speaking of that, how did you start with the idea? I mean, that's a lot of production to do.
Yeah, there is a story.
I found the tweet from you ages ago saying it would be great if they had like some sort of iPad app or some sort of app for Cinefax.
Oh, see, there we go.
Yeah. Oh, very good. So the tweet came from while I was out working on this crazy film in which the pitch was, yeah, we're on $1 million budget and we need to do creatures, so we're training baby pigs from birth to wear costumes and hit their marks.
Like you do.
Yeah. And they wanted me to come out. They needed somebody to sub in for their close contact at Molecule, who I think was going to a bachelor weekend or something. And they had the extra motivation to get somebody from SF because they had gotten a film commission grant. So they were trying to bring as much work to San Francisco as they could to honor that grant. So all these texts were going around frantically for a few days, like, you know, who's available to go out to fly out to Louisiana and do this. And I really was, when I heard about this baby pig thing, I was starting to try to find them somebody else to maybe help them out, because it happened to be,
understandably,
yeah,
you know, children and animals you usually don't want to work with either,
right? Well, and
children, animals in this case.
Yes, exactly. When you combine both of them, it's definitely a no.
Yeah, and this will get around to the story of how Cinefax came to be a twinkle in the eye, but I ended up seeing some of the director's other work, and I realized that he's got this very visually poetic, metaphorical style, and that what they were doing was really up his alley. And actually, they're very perfectionistic about how they photograph their projects. So I started to see, like, oh, okay, they're not, it's not like they're trying to do Avatar with baby pigs. They're actually trying to do their film with this. So I went out and I had this great, great adventure. My kids came along, and because there were kids on set, it actually, that worked out well, because, you know, normally I would never take kids to a film set. It's just deadly dull. But it happened that they had people caring for them, and everybody was just so great on that show. My God, what a motley crew, mostly New Yorkers who had just relocated down to the bayous, were living on nothing, making nothing, and having the time of their lives, I think, working on this movie and being this huge just band of artistes. So we just got to drop in on them for a week. But anyway, when we were heading out, this is so cool, the actual facility where they were doing the practical effects, if I can call it a facility, was actually a former squat in a abandoned firehouse just outside the quarter in what I think is called Metairie. So just a few blocks outside the French Quarter. You know, I live in San Francisco, and I've heard stories about what the 50s and 60s were like here, where people would just take over an old factory and it would become Project Artaud, and suddenly it's these radical artists. And now 40 years later, they're all in these $1 million lofts because they bought the whole building for half of that. And, you know, those days are long gone, but they're alive and well in New Orleans. So they had this really cool old shack of a huge ramshackle kind of place to raise their pigs and train them from birth and make the little costumes. And I met up with Ray, who was the practical effects supervisor. I said, you know, where are you getting all the data for how to do this? Like, you're trying to shoot them in slow-mo and they've got to interact with soil. So you got to get the soil of the right weight. And are you mining old issues of Cinefex or something? And he goes, and he goes over to a shelf and he reaches up and he pulls down his prized few dog-eared eBay collectible issues of the early Cinefex, which were the source of all the knowledge for how to do high-speed photography of miniatures interacting in soil.
Wow.
And I just had, it was a light bulb, you know? I just thought, wow, this cannot be the only guy who, while the whole world has turned its attention to $200 million movies, is trying to make a movie on the old budget using some of the old means combined with computers, but not doing the whole thing with computers. Therefore, I thought it drove home again the kind of value in these old magazines. The other thing is that behind the scenes aspect, because there's a problem solving to how all these shots were worked out, that is still very much part of it. It just happens in people's heads more. They used to do a lot more messing around with lighting steel wool on fire and stuff like that. Whereas, you know, now it's kind of interactions with the R&D department, and it makes Cinefex less interesting to some people to read because, I have to say they've gotten a lot better. They don't just say, oh, we wrote some proprietary software and solved it that way. There was a period where I think in the late 90s it got a little bit dire with shot after shot inside ILM with, you know, the Venetian blinds and the SGI workstation and the description of what the R&D department had done.
Basically, ILM did this shot.
Right.
You know, and next page.
Full stop. Yeah.
Yeah, and you'd always hope that the model shop had somehow been involved so that there'd be some color. So, yeah, with that light bulb, I put out that tweet. And nobody picked up that ball and ran with it. And I had a teeny bit of a relationship with the publisher because I had actually been in contact with them while I was creating the first book, because I was trying to get some of the movies I'd worked on included in the book. And I was trying to get an idea from Cinefex what was involved getting rights for that kind of thing. And I chased that for a while and we kind of abandoned it. There were no Hollywood shots other than from television in the book because the terms were just kind of untenable. But so I had Don's number. I called him up. I kind of gave him the pitch and we kept talking. And I was really only talking about the back catalog, which I think we still have yet to prove to Cinefex that it has value. I think that they're more used to collectors who want to have the old Cinefex and kind of their loyal readership than they are that it's part of the living, breathing process that would still be useful and interesting to artists today. So,
well, I have an example for you if you want to take it back to them.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Because I do collect the Cinefex and I have them over there in my bookshelf. And I also build things. And I was looking at, Christopher and I talked about this recently. I was looking at the issue that had John Dykstra in it, and they were talking about the Dykstra flight camera and what caused them to create it and then how they created it and, you know, the steps that went into even thinking about creating it. And it gave me some really good ideas about something that I wanted to build. So now I can actually take my iPad to my shop and still have that thing that spurred my interest in my shop. But my Cinefexes are still sitting on my shelf here because I do collect them, you know.
Safe and sound. And that's just it. They become, the actual books become artifacts. And, you know, they sit on the shelf because they're beautiful and they're prized. But the iPad version is not lovely because, A, it's portable, right? Because we all have our iPads with us all the time. You know, you have the entire collection, it's searchable, you can get what you want, find it fairly easily. But also, it's all there, it's all right there. When, in this day and age where traditional publishing is dying in a very, very rapid fashion, why wouldn't you want to make that transition to digital where especially with a quarter annual publication, is, you know, seasonal publication, you know, you've got plenty of time to really craft each issue and make it interactive and make it really special and make it really shine. You know, why wouldn't you want to do that?
Yeah, and the cross-referencing aspect that you're talking about is non-trivial, but definitely was a big part of the pitch, i.e., it's something that the editors at Cinefix said, well, God, we wish we had this. We wish we could search across the back catalog. And it wasn't, in some ways, such a difficult pitch because, frankly, Cinefix isn't making any money anymore off their most prized issues because they're sold out of them. So really, you can only get them on eBay. So it's a gamble. We'll see. But the theory is that there's going to be a kind of an evergreen component to discovering the value of some of these. And, you know, for some people, there's also nostalgia. I'm really excited to get the back catalog actually in there.
How long do you think that's going to take? Because I noticed, yeah, a lot of them are coming soon and such. So I was wondering, like, well, what's the turnaround time for a particular issue?
Well, there's various things that are working in parallel for it to happen. It is software development, so the how long is it going to take question is always, especially with a small team.
Right.
That is often the difficult question. But we're focused on it now, and we have actually a really good reason, which I can't reveal, to get right on it. There's something kind of in the works that I'm really excited about, a kind of a tie-in, if you will, that speaks to what we're talking about here in terms of the relevance and some of the old stories. So let's see what we can do.
Cool. You've almost heard it here first, yeah. Folks.
Yeah.
Actually, it sounds really exciting. I was very pleased when I downloaded it and took a look at it, because the big problem that I have with a lot of the new digital publications is that they're using InDesign or they're using some sort of system where they wind up publishing gigantic images for each page. You know, so it's not accessible, you can't search, you can't do anything. And you guys really took the time to do it right. You've got the multimedia aspect, but you also have real text and searchable material.
Yes. Now, to nerd out on that a little bit, we initially pitched a pure HTML5 platform, and it turns out with a traditional publisher, that's really kind of a no-go because of the need to carefully handle type. So until HTML includes that level of type handling, which I don't know that it ever will. You know, if the ragged right is a little bit too ragged for the publisher's taste and they want to introduce some hyphenation to clean it up, etc., you can imagine what happens. I mean, it's just not what the format is designed to do. And we worked, it actually added a lot of time to the development trying to solve this. And we had to end up with a bit of a hybrid. The other piece being that we discussed having there be a streaming option as opposed to having the whole new issues load onto the device. And Cinefix felt strongly that they wanted the whole issues on there. They didn't want to hear from people who were stuck somewhere where they couldn't access the content. And we're at the stage, by the way, with the whole app where the Vox Populi is fully in play and there is a place in the app to make a comment. So if you feel, for example, that you know, the footprint of the new issues is rather large and a streaming component would be an appealing option, that is a perfect candidate to send us a note about that. Or, you know, whatever you find in there, we're really kind of taking all the comments in the aggregate and really enjoying what we're hearing as well.
Cool.
It's been a good reception for it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's, I have to emphasize, I mean, we built it from the ground up, and I can't take credit for that, but it was coded from the ground up by a developer who's really gifted with 3D. So the UI that you see on the front of it, which is, you know, really just a taste of what I'd love to do more of. Well, I mean, I can't promise how much more of that will be in there until we move forward in general with our publishing platform and, you know, maybe find another partner who really actually wants the graphic component, because that's a big part of where we come from. All of us who are working on it, we're really good at at that piece of it.
It's a really good effect, I have to say. It's, you know, it's that really neat.
Yeah, it's kind of cool.
So if you haven't downloaded the app, I highly suggest downloading the app. It's free.
Yeah, it's free.
You can even download a free issue as well to see what's inside.
127 is the free issue, and we're going to
But the way they're doing the table of contents for the, or rather the bookshelf, as it were, it's really quite interesting. They've got each cover on display each year, each quarter's cover, and then you can pan left or right, but you're actually panning on an angle, so you're actually going into the Z index as well, which is really it looks really fantastic, and it's smooth as silk too, which, unlike a lot of other apps out there that wind up, it doesn't get locked in a 60 frame per second, so it's not as smooth, whereas this is really amazing.
Yeah, we're working right on the GPU. We've gotten really nice comments that people, nerds, love the parallaxing stars.
Yes.
And that's a big hit.
Right.
Very proud of that one. And I was wanting to add that right now it's not obvious. We actually have an update coming that will clarify this, but it's not easy to find that issue 127, which is the earliest of the currently available new format issues, is actually the free one. We're going to kind of put a banner on there to make it a little more obvious.
Right.
I'd also like to point out to people who haven't tried it yet that free issue is just chock-a-block full of all this extra content. I was really happy to see that. So you can kind of test drive the app. There's a lot in there.
Yeah,
it's the full issue, and the newer ones have even more. I think 130 kind of set the record for the amount of supporting material that's in it. But yeah, it's fully representative.
Yeah, it's very cool. I was actually really curious as to how you guys did the text flow. I mean, Cortex is actually really nice. It gives you a lot of control, but still flowing text over page, over page, over page, that's hard.
Well, as I said, we started with a pure HTML5 basis, and we actually were starting it on the back issues with that too. So what we were trying to do was lay them out in HTML to look like the back issues looked.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah, and we got really close, but we had a really pesky problem with widows and orphans, particularly at the end of a page. And there was, you're pointing out the right problem, flowing text cleanly, especially with narrow columns like that, was really kind of a bitch. And on the wider format that Cinefex designed for their new issues, and that's purely their design, they were very strong about how they wanted it to look. That was actually behaving itself much better because of the column width. But we ended up with all of it actually going to a hybridized design where the HTML is now living underneath it, which gives you the searchability, but actually that's a PNG. So it's lighter than a PDF, but it's still an image. It's a, you know, it's a run length encoded image that's presenting that text on those pages.
Right. So it's actually that image is generated on the fly because it looks gorgeous on a Retina display. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we definitely hit the timing right to get it good for the Retina display. And this is the kind of podcast where I can say things like this. We've had a couple gripes of people saying, oh, the image compression's not good, or, you know, like they looked at an image and said, well, I can see some of the artifacting, or looks a little pixelated. The truth is that what the studios provide to Cinefex often shows up with pretty gnarly artifacts. So even though they're usually getting high res, which no longer means film res.
It's a high enough res, right?
Well, yeah, they're usually, honestly, typically they're getting 1920 images. That's kind of become the standard now for anything. So, you know, everything's kind of starts and ends at HD these days. So the vast majority of the shots, other than the ones that maybe were taken on set, look like that. And yeah, some of them just come in. I mean, we have tried to, you know, we have some tricks to fix them and improve them. And at least from the standpoint of not wasting so much image compression on all that crap, we put a lot of time into, because it's what we know how to do, finding that sweet spot where you're not losing any detail, but you're reducing the amount of just pure noise in the image. But in some cases, what they're getting is really execrable. So we're not, just like anybody else in this business, we're not really able to polish the proverbial...
fix it in post.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
So we're going to start a petition, and we're going to make sure that the studios hand you 4K plates from now on.
By and large, the stuff is not bad.
So, in looking up and trying to data mine you, I found out that you sing.
Well, I come by it honestly because my mom is a lifelong opera singer and singing teacher. That's what she always did. I grew up with it. I got the male version of her voice. She's a contralto. Before my voice changed, people used to mistake us on the phone for one another. And, and then I was kind of thespy in high school.
There's a salve for that, you know.
Yeah, exactly. So that was a big activity in high school and college. And I briefly did a little bit of professional work, but like a gnat's blink of an eye. And then, of course, as anyone sensibly does in acting, decided if there was anything else I could really be doing and be happy, then I should probably do that. So I chose VFX, which is now becoming another industry in which if there's anything else you could be happy doing, you might want to think about doing that.
I'm sensing a theme here. So when you figure out what it is that you're going to do next, let me know ahead of time so I make sure I'm not in that industry.
You can bet it's going to become the next bleeding heart. Everyone wants to do it kind of. But these are actually great things to do and a lot of fun. And, you know, the acapella came up because it was something I could do as, you know, rehearse once a week, go do it and just really sing. And I haven't done it in a while. And I actually am thinking about getting back to it. I'm not crazy about choir singing. You meet a lot of serious choir nerds when you go out, especially as you get into some of the better groups. And I never really was one of those guys. I did have a group that was really great. They were a really fun set of people. And we started doing in concert musicals. So we were staging, it's something they do off Broadway too, where they'll take a musical like one of the Sondheims and they'll do an in concert version. So they focus on the music and they play out the script just kind of sitting right there with the orchestra doing it. So we did a couple of these. We did Into the Woods and Little Shop of Horrors. And in both, I got just the part I would have wanted. I was the plant.
Nice.
Oh, nice.
that's the only part that matters.
Yeah. And in Into the Woods, I don't know if you know that one, but the wolf slash Cinderella's prince is just the best. I remember seeing it. Yeah. I mean, when it first came out, I was a teenager and, I remember thinking, oh, that's the part for me. So I finally got to do it.
Very cool.
So yeah, those were fun. And I need a singing outlet. You've struck a nerve. See? When I get over this cold. Yeah.
There you go.
It's really pure music. My mother used to proudly say that singing is the most difficult instrument.
I think your mother's right.
There's a lot of variables there. I mean, you know, picked up stringed instruments at a fairly young age, and you put your finger on a particular area of the string, and unless it's poorly out of tune, it's going to sound the same all the time. You know, you can kind of tweak it to get a little bit of a life out of it, but, you know, it's not like vocal cords where, you know, any given day it's going to be a very different set of variables.
Yeah, and God forbid it's before noon.
But yeah, I think we've got a theme here. I think, you know, we can get more people on the show and we can have a podcast band.
Yeah, I like that idea.
We can get Mike J. Nichols to be on guitar. we can get you to sing. We can get Colin to do other stringed instruments or guitar as well. We need a drummer.
Oh, they're out there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I have a good, somebody almost just came to mind, but I have a good tie-in here for you. I once had the privilege with one of the choirs that I sang with, actually the cool one that I was talking about, where I was friends with all the people, as opposed to thinking they were a bunch of choir dorks. We went up to Skywalker Ranch and recorded, we were doing vocal tangos, and it was an unusual enough project that their Grammy award-winning engineer decided to kind of give us her time and use of the studio for the weekend to host us and record us for a couple of days and master this thing.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, and the extra cool thing for me is, of course, as an ex-Lucas employee, I'd been up to the ranch a bunch. In some ways, you could say I knew it like the back of my hand, but as an employee, you've got a little bit of the look but don't touch or you'll get fired kind of attitude, particularly if you don't work there. I mean, if you work at the ranch, your office can be a freaking pigsty and you have a lot more liberty. But the rest of us employees who'd go up there from San Rafael, you know, it was just like, wow, people really don't even belong here. We're just not meant to really muss the ranch at all. And so there was all this cool stuff that you could do up there that I never did until I stayed in the Kurosawa suite, because what came with being recording artists was that we were offered the opportunity to stay at the ranch and nobody else did it. I'm like, you guys, you've got to be kidding me. Like,
yeah, are you crazy?
Yeah, really? Come on. This is a once in a lifetime thing.
Yeah, well, and it was subsidized. So I think we paid like $100 to stay in the Kurosawa guest cottage, which is all done in the Japanese motif. Each room, you know, has its own famous filmmaker motif. And of course, it's all just exceptionally curated. And then I got to do all this stuff. I got to light a fire in the little fire pit outside. I got to go jump in the pool and splash around. I rode the bikes around. I went out to the farm and petted the goat.
If someone asks you to stay in the Kurosawa suite, you say yes.
Yeah, or any of them.
Or just stay on the ranch at all.
Really? Yeah, even come with on. A sleeping bag would probably not be that
why
bad.
Would you not do that?
Yeah.
But wow.
I think you get a little jaded. You live in the area. You think, oh, I just want to go home. I don't think people really processed it.
Well, I think there's something to that as well. Like if you're working there and you're an employee, it's all kind of, this is my workplace. I don't want to be there any more than I need to be. You know, I want to be back home with my family. I want to be this. I want to do that. But if you're just there as a guest, then it's a magical wonderland. Like yeah, when totally. I was in Pixar a few months back, it's one of those magical places where, you know, I don't work there. And so it's all just taking it in.
Yeah.
It's all just a part of being there.
Well, and that place has a particular energy that is unmistakable.
Yeah.
That's one of my favorite places.
I found it really weird that despite the fact that they're in Northern California, that all of their buildings are named after places in New York. I was like, wait a minute. So we're going to go into Brooklyn now. I'm like, wait, what? No, what? So yeah, it was a little weird, but yeah, it was such an amazing experience.
Yeah, it's a great place. And that's really, in many ways, the opposite of what I'm talking about. You know, Pixar is very human scale, and if it were devoid of people, it would feel really wrong. Whereas Skywalker Ranch would always feel like there should just be droids and projections, animatronics running the whole...
And untouched landscapes that are being painted by master painters.
Yeah, yeah. I would even tell people, going in, there were some kind of farm implement artifacts that you pass on the way in, and I'd tell people, oh, those are fake, and you know, everybody would believe me. Somehow when I went into tour guide mode, I could say whatever I want, and people would just buy
just
it.
Just go with it. Yeah, that stuff over there, yeah, it's a matte painting. That's not real.
Yeah. George comes out here and plows the land every day.
We always said we were going to go find the remnants of the Ewok village, which is somewhere allegedly up on the hill. But I've never talked to anybody who actually succeeded in that quest.
Oh, wow. Because, yeah, wasn't that filmed in Millwood? I can't recall.
Well, mostly way up north in Trinity County. But oh, okay. I think they did a couple pickups. Well, this is the story, that they did a couple pickups right there. And it's just the kind of thing George would do. you know, like, we shot one of the shots on a digital camera. We're not going to tell you which one.
Right. And just sort of insert it there and say, okay, you know, here you go. Done.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. It's probably the quote unquote set is probably like six logs and some trees. No one will ever find it.
Well, or it could have been one of the scaled miniature. You know, I always pictured it as being one of the shots that's a little bit wider that could be at like half size, you know, where you see all the little walkways and stuff.
Yeah, I'm having a hard time picturing it. I've kind of pushed it out of my head.
Okay. Well, you know, the prequels did that for you.
I didn't find the Ewoks nearly as terrible as I found.
Yeah, go ahead, go there.
I found Jar Jar, or even as I found the droid army.
I'm sorry. What's a Jar Jar?
Exactly. Exactly.
There was foreshadowing, certainly, of how not sacred the casting was going to become of these creatures, but. Only foreshadowing.
Oh, my goodness.
This podcast, if we don't get around to Star Wars.
It's not a podcast.
That's how you know when the pod people have taken over, when we're not talking about Star Wars at some point.
Right. And, well, you know, it's funny because in contrast to, you know, Lucas, and of course they're coming out with the 3D versions of Episode 1, 2, and 3.
Yeah.
I think in the autumn sometime. In contrast, Spielberg has decided up and down, you know, I did that thing with E.T., but I'm going to pretend like that never happened.
Yeah, God love
it. I'm not going to do that anymore. Yeah. It's not going to happen. Which is really lovely that he was able to say, okay, you know, I thought it was a good idea, and in retrospect, it really wasn't, and I won't do it again. I'm sorry.
Right, and the Jaws Blu-ray is spectacular.
I heard you tweet, saw the tweet, that you had. I'm really looking forward to my copy.
Cool.
So, Mark, thank you very much for coming on and taking the time to chat with us.
Thank you.
It was been a pleasure.
Indeed.
Where can we find you on the vast internet?
Right. Well, predominantly, if you want it to be timely and relevant, you will find me checking in on Twitter. One thing we didn't talk about is how I've been working full-time at Adobe for the last year, and that actually has made me a little tongue-tied because a lot of the time I haven't felt that free to talk about what was going on in my workday.
Right.
So right. It kind of cut off the natural process of sharing, but
well, if we get all of our listeners to sign NDAs, I think we'll be good to go.
Yeah, brilliant. No, I foresee moving out of this phase, but meanwhile, Twitter is kind of so Flowseeker on Twitter is going to be the place where you're going to catch up with me.
Right on. Very cool. Very cool. So, Maggie, where can we find you?
You can find me on Twitter as well at TANKGRRL. I've also joined darksideapp.net. I am M. McPhee there. Or you can find me at about.me/Maggie McPhee on the web. And where can we find you, Jack?
You can find me also on Twitter at Octothorpe, OctoThorpe. I'm also on app.net with the same name because it was easier that way. Again, Mark, thank you very, very much.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
That was another episode of Ruining It for Everyone with your hosts Maggie McPhee and Christopher Harrington. Music provided by Kevin MacLeod. You can find us at ruiningitforeveryone.tv or search for Ruining It for Everyone on iTunes. Be sure to subscribe and rate the show as it really helps us out.
Okay, recording.
Okay, yep. Now we can cut.
One, two, three.
Oh, that wasn't together at all.
That was actually pretty it was reasonable.
Or if it's a repeated sequence and they're talking about a particular thing that you didn't quite catch, you know, you start to get a little more lost. And if you I hear my neighbor shouting about the Giants game, by the way. I don't know if you guys can hear that in the background. It's pretty funny.
Yeah, I was wondering, I was like, is that a cat?
Yeah. Oh, we're all very passionate about the Giants out here in San Francisco.
See, we have different Giants over here.
Yes, I know. I know, I'm sorry.
Totally different Giants.
They used to be the same ones, but not anymore.
I've been here long enough that I have a lot of American colloquialisms, and they all sound really weird. But yeah, the like thing, a lot of the throwaway words I just picked up here, and now I can't get rid of them.
There's a few Englishisms that I miss, like twee and naff, that I really wish I could just freely use because they're useful. Twee is really useful.
I give you full permission to use them.
There's some stuff for the Australian stuff that I've kept. I still use whilst. I think it's a great word.
Oh, well, that's just good English. In any language, that's just the King's English. But, you know, the problem with busting out a really great colloquialism is if you have to explain it, then you just regret it. You just never want to do it again.
I actually had someone come up to me quasi-randomly and ask me what Bob's your uncle meant. Like, really?
I have wondered about this.
Am I just the representative?
Yeah.
For Bob. Yeah.
This happened to me at Diesel Cafe, actually, in Davis Square, while I was up near you last weekend, yeah.
Just randomly. Like, they heard your accent and decided to...
Right. And engage in conversation with me, starting with that question.
Wow.
It was, is that an iPad? Yes, it was. What does Bob's your uncle mean? It was that awkward. I'm like, is this being filmed? Right. What's going on
here?
Am
I being punked?
Yeah, it was a little bit strange.
for a woman in the UK, somehow a guy can't. I never met a dude who could pull this off, but just to say, oh, pants, as a
pants is a great word. You're right, and not anyone can do it.
Pants is brilliant.
I just think that's it's so great.
Oh my! But yeah, there are weird Americanisms that I can't really say because they're ridiculous. But I love saying them anyway. Like y'all.
Yeah.
Precisely. That is precisely the reason why I don't say it very often.
Oh. All right, we better move on to the editor. Hi, editor. It's going to hate us.
Oh, good, because we're going to start doing Monty Python Texan accents.